And Ranabel? Well, let's look at Annabelle. Talk about Annabelle. Who's Annabelle? She belongs to Donna, Angie replied, the demonologist by Gerald Brittle, same fellow who wrote the other book, The Devil in Connecticut. Now, this book's out of print. Except I persuaded, through Craig today, Bannon Books to print a special printing just for me. And I'm going to give this book away at the banquets. Because I can't take the time to read it all. We were in the second exorcism last night when I quit, right? Okay. Got several things to do. But let's go to Annabelle. Who's Annabelle? She belongs to Donna, Angie replied. Belongs? Question Lorraine, is Annabelle a live, breathing being? Is she alive? Donna repeated quizzically. She moves. She acts alive, but no, I don't think... What's that line on over there for? Is she alive? Well, she moves. She acts alive, but no, I don't think she's alive. Annabelle's in the living room, said Angie, pointing across the table. She's sitting on the sofa. Lorraine looked to her left, into the living room. Are you talking about that doll? Well, you know the story. These two nurses had called the Catholic demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren. They had a Raggedy Ann doll. They'd leave it in one room, come home, be in another room. They'd leave it with its arms hanging down, and the arms would be crossed when they came home. Then they went to see a medium. The medium in a trance began to talk to them, said there was a little girl named Annabelle that had died. Used to play in the fields where their house is. Now there's nobody there but grown-ups, had nobody to play with. Could she come in and live with them? And she had moved the doll around to get their attention. They said yes. They said they were compassionate nurses. So now the spirit moved into Annabelle. But they asked Lou about it, the boyfriend of one of these nurses. And Lou, he didn't have the same attitude. Not at all. He says, the damn voodoo doll, that's what it is. Lou blurted out. I told him about that thing a long time ago. The doll just taking advantage of him. Let me put it this way. I didn't like the doll. The doll didn't like me right back. The thing's got a mind. Dolls don't have a mind, right? So from the beginning, I didn't think this thing moving around their apartment was cute. So Lou, he has a bad time. Angie and I were alone together one night, he says, about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we were reading over maps because I was going off on a trip the next day. Everything was quiet at the time. Suddenly, we both heard sounds in Donna's bedroom that made us think that someone had broken into the apartment. I quietly got up and tiptoed to the bedroom door, which was closed. I waited until the noises stopped, then I carefully opened the door and reached in and switched on the light. Nobody was in there, except the Annabelle doll was tossed on the floor in a corner. I went in alone, walked over to the thing to see if anything unusual had happened. But as I got close to the doll, I got the distinct impression that somebody was behind me. I swung around instantly and, well, he won't talk about that part, Angie said. When Lou turned around, there wasn't anybody there, but he suddenly yelled and grabbed for his chest. He was doubled over, cut and bleeding when I got to him. Now, the witnesses to the murder trial, well, the witnesses to the killing where Arnie Cheyenne Johnson is tried for murder and sentenced to prison until 2001 A.D. is there now. In the final exorcism of Little David in this book, when everyone was afraid that the struggles and resistance of the demons was going to result in the death of David, Arnie threw himself on David and begged the demon to take him and spare David. Witnesses to the death at the time that the drunken friend was killed. Arnie, for example, is at a friend's house who is a drunk. As they're leaving, the drunk tries to restrain Debbie's little girl. In the determination to leave, the drunk didn't want him to leave. He challenged Arnie to a fight, began to attack him physically. Arnie grabbed him by the hands. They, in essence, were pushing at each other. And suddenly, witnesses saw the symptoms of demon possession take over in Arnie. But the witnesses say he flung the fellow several feet away. And after he was flung several feet away, he doubled over, fell. Arnie, in his demonic state, ran down the road, later to be picked up many hours later in a daze, not knowing anything that he did. The witnesses to the fight turned the victim over. He had two stab wounds. Blood was flowing. Subsequently, in the morgue, became five wounds. Time the police took him to the morgue. They then found a knife laying on the ground with blood on it, no fingerprints, but it was a knife that had belonged to Arnie. The witnesses who saw the fight said he was flung from Arnie. No knife was involved in the fight. And Arnie's defense, therefore, was he didn't stab him. The demon did. Obviously, a judge wouldn't accept that. And the judge then translated the plea of the court-appointed attorney into a plea for insanity, and under a technicality of court rules, because a certain paper had not been filed requesting the right to plead insanity, his defense was stricken. And he then was, on circumstantial evidence, judged guilty of manslaughter and sent to prison until 2001 A.D. If these stories are true, they're all unbelievable. If they're true, the capacity of a demon, unseen, to stab somebody is cropping up over and over again. Here's another illustration of it. He doubled over, cut and bleeding, when I got to him. Blood was all over his shirt. Hey, if you're watching for the first time, I don't believe this stuff either. It's what's bugging the living daylights out of me. Why am I forced to confront true stories that I can't believe? It's as bad as the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Anybody in the right mind knows it couldn't happen. But it did. Anybody in the right mind knows this didn't happen. Convince Lou. He was double over, cut and bleeding when I got to him. Blood was all over his shirt. Lou was shaking and scared, and we went back into the living room. We then opened up his shirt, and there on his chest was what looked to be a sort of claw mark. "Can I see the mark?" Ed asked. "It's gone now," the young man told him. "I saw the cuts on his chest, too. I went right by it, and you guys didn't even notice. You know where I left off last time?" "Can I see the mark?" Ed asked. "Where'd you get this crowd tonight, Mike?" "Can I see the mark?" Ed asked. "It's gone now," the young man told him. "I saw the cuts on his chest, too." By the way, when the little boy David saw the being flying, remember, he put his hand over his eyes or closed his eyes. Remember that. Particularly when I get... No, just remember it. "Oh, I saw the cuts on her chest, too," Donna spoke up in support. "How many were they?" Ed asked. "Seven," said Angie. "Three were vertical, four were horizontal." "Did the cuts have any sensation?" "All the cuts were hot, like they were burns," Lou told him. "Did you ever have cuts or wounds in the same area of your chest before this incident happened?" questioned Ed. "No," the young man replied. "Did you lose consciousness before or after the attack took place?" "No," was his answer again. "How long did it take the wounds to heal?" Lorraine then wanted to know. They healed almost immediately, said Lou. They were half gone the next day and fully gone the day after. Has anything else happened since that time? Asked Ed. No, came the joint reply. Who did you first contact after the incident occurred? I contacted an Episcopal priest named Father Hagen, Donna told Ed and Lorraine. Why'd you decide to call him instead of a doctor? Lorraine asked. Well, do you think someone off the street would have believed where that claw mark on Lou's chest came from? Donna asked rhetorically. Besides, we agreed the cuts weren't half as important as how Lou got them. We wanted to know if this was going to happen again. Our problem was who to ask. Was there some reason why you specifically called on Father Hagen? Yes, we trust him, said Donna. He teaches nearby here at a junior college, plus Angie and I both know him. Well, what'd you tell the priest, said Ed? The whole story about Annabelle and how it moved on its own, especially about Lou's cuts. At first, we were afraid he might not believe us, but that was no problem. He believed us all right, although, she finished, he said he'd never heard of such thing happening these days. At the time, we were scared out of our wits and asked him what he thought had happened to us. What'd he tell you? He said he didn't want to speculate, but he did seem to feel it was a spiritual matter, possibly an important one, and said he was going to contact someone higher up in the church, a Father Cook. That's what he did, Ed told her. Angie then asked the Warrens concerningly, what do you think did that to Lou's chest? Well, let's discuss that in a minute, Ed answered. He like me. First, to finish up, let me just ask you a few questions. Has this kind of thing ever happened to you before, to any of you? No, they told the Warrens. Did the name Annabelle or Annabelle Higgins mean anything to you in real life before this incident occurred? No. Although you never saw anything spirit-wise in here, Lou said he felt a presence in the room before he got hurt. There is something in here, Angie stated firmly. In fact, I can't even stand to be here. We decided to get a new apartment. We're moving out. I'm afraid that's not going to help you very much, Ed said dryly. What do you mean? Donna asked, astonished. To put it in a nutshell, folks, you inadvertently brought a spirit into this apartment and into your lives, and you're not going to be able to walk away from it that easily. It's going to take too long to finish that one tonight before 10:30 when we join some other stations. So let me just leave Annabelle there. Then you get where we left it? It's not high tension or drama. It's just not that easy to get rid of this spirit now that it's moved in. Now, we're going to join Memphis on Channel 30 and Dallas-Fort Worth. I suppose I could be persuaded to pick up, but I also got this exorcism to do. And I got old Grindel charging in on Beowulf. And I got something new I want to introduce tonight, the way of the shaman. Now, why don't you give me some music like I Want to Know? And if you want me to keep going on it, of course, I don't have to do any of this, do I? I'm going to give the book away about the exorcism, so I don't have to finish that unless you're awfully nice to me. So the number is 1-800-338-3030. I think it's time you talk to me and help me push toward my million. If you give me enough push, then I'll keep going. Everybody think I'm a nut? I have been dealing with the supernatural, preternatural, spirit world, demonology. I've been reading from enough different sources to just make a simple point that I want to gestalt. there's too much here to ignore. I don't believe these stories, but every indication is they're true. I'm a natural-born skeptic. I run by my five senses. But I simply cannot avoid the reality of the evidence. Now, I was reading last night the book The Devil in Connecticut by Gerald Brittle. It culminates in a murder trial in Superior Court in Danbury, Connecticut, and it was preceded by one of the worst cases of demon possession recorded in modern day. This story makes The Exorcist look tame. The Devil in Connecticut. And without reviewing it all and hoping that the people that are watching the first time will not write me off out of hand, but will listen, because my point is simply to cover enough material that you will comprehend that there's too much here to ignore. And I brought us up to the point of the exorcism of the little boy that was demon-possessed, David Glassell. Four Catholic priests tried the first exorcism, and they failed. They were afraid the boy would die in the middle of the exorcism. They were inexperienced, relatively, exorcists, and they stopped the exorcism process with the boy still possessed. A second exorcism was staged. The story to date indicated that the boy himself had had materializations in his demonic states of 43 demons. Now, it is very clear from Scripture that there are a hierarchy of demons. I taught last night from the Judaic Encyclopedia the different names for demons that are proper names that in the King James are translated into generic statements of conditions. A female demon with a proper name was translated in the King James, screech owl. Another demon with a proper name was translated wild beast. There was a hierarchy of demons. New Testament makes this clear, if you believe the New Testament. Some demons, apparently the 70 disciples, could cast them out easily. But after the Mount of Transfiguration experience, there was a boy possessed with demons, and the disciples couldn't deliver him. Jesus cast the demons out and said, "This kind cometh out not without fasting and prayer," much fasting and prayer. The Old Testament recognized a hierarchy of demons. The Lord of this world has many lieutenants, and he has foot soldiers. Now, the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine, Catholic demonologists, distinguish between leadership evil spirits, calling them devils, and the weaker, lesser ones, called demons. I don't utilize their terminology. I think there's only one devil and hierarchies of demons. But words, you can stipulate their meanings or have reportive meanings. As long as you understand, there is a Lord over these beings, the prince of the power of the air, and there are generals under him, and lieutenants, and foot soldiers, whatever name you put on them. This little boy, in the final stages of possession, by the methods of both the discerning of spirits and his own testimony, had 43 demons in him. In the first exorcism, some of the weaker demons left. If the story's true, I don't believe this. You think I can just sit down and read this one of these nights and not be thought a nut? I really don't care. But I would like people to listen and make your own judgments after you hear it all. Is there a basis for believing any of this? Now, don't carry on long conversation, Voices of Faith. I'm carrying on and carrying on. But don't anybody get on the phone and ask my Voices of Faith about me. If you want to know about me, listen to me. Now, I want to teach. And I get frustrated at people talking about me when they could be listening to me. So, bring your conversations to a close. Somebody called last night from Dallas and says, you drop your hints like an anvil, don't you? Now, you can all drop your phones like an anvil. The first exorcism failed, though some of the demons left. The second exorcism was staged. Remember, the Catholic Church has a very complicated procedure for exorcisms. And when the movie The Exorcist came out, the publicity made the Catholic Church even more sensitive. I'm not Catholic. In fact, particularly come December time, people who don't listen to me of the Catholic faith may become angry with me because I will teach on the traditions of Christmas and where some of them came from. I don't try to change people from the Catholic faith. I just try to teach both Protestants and Catholics and Jews and myself to know their faith and to know what came in because of encroachment of outside traditions and what came from the scriptural frame. Jews ought to know which feast days were added when they came back from Babylon under the influence of Babylonian activity, as distinct from those feast days that were laid upon them by God from the book of Leviticus by Moses. That doesn't mean they all have to come from Moses. Purim came out of the book of Esther and the events of Mordecai and Haman in a very legitimate celebration of God's deliverance and the dignity of freedom and serving God and not man. Same out of the Maccabean period comes Hanukkah. You'll be intelligent about your faith. I can tell you the Pope knows the history of the church and knows where traditions came into the stream. But I'm neither am I an evangelist who says God doesn't hear the prayers of Catholics and Jews. Jesus said, other sheep of mine. That's outside even the Christian stream. And these are Catholic exorcists, and they're attacking the enemy better than some Protestants. That I know. Now, I'm leaving a few cities now, but I'm going to leave them talking. Bye. Just give a visual crawl at the end. Don't say anything. I want to do the same. I got to get on with this. They then came to a second exorcism, and these were not experienced exorcists, and the Catholic Church had not authorized a full binding of Satan and a complete exorcism of the house. They only authorized the exorcism of this boy. Now they're trying a second time. They even took the boy out of the house, remember, and moved him over to a convent. In the Donovan case, there was an experienced exorcist, and he was authorized to exorcise the house and to bind the demon. Each of these acts required church authorities okay, including preliminary filings of verifications and other things. Now they're to the second exorcism, same relatively inexperienced priest. Finally, at 3 o'clock, the exorcism began in earnest. It was the same lengthy reading attempted in the chapel on September 2nd, second time now. But the scene in the convent was drastically different from the previous one. This time there was no interference. The prayers and psalms were recited without interruption. There was no spitting, biting, cursing, or screaming. Everyone waited for an interruption, if not a confrontation, but none arose. At 4 o'clock, the final prayer of thanksgiving and beseechment was read aloud, and I'll skip over that. Father Vergilak then rendered a formal blessing on David. It was over. The deed had been done. What mattered now was the effect. Would this stop possession of David? I tell you, no. They didn't call for the demon to identify himself or leave some sign of his departure. They just sort of smoked in the dark. Midnight that night, ...12:30 to be exact, David came under possession again. The priests were there watching, ready to enter the battle again. A heart-sinking alarm was raised by Paul Bartz, an assistant of Ed and Lorraine. He's going under. David's whole body began to vibrate. His eyes rolled up into his head. Moments later, he was under. Leave! The possessing entity screamed at the priests. David jumped to his feet, demanding in a vehement man's voice, "Get out! You're not getting him!" Oh, you're going to run a crawl. I was ready to see my face revolve as we joined Bay City, Saginaw, Flint, Michigan, Augusta, Georgia. Possessing entity screamed at the priest. David jumped to his feet, demanding a vehement man's voice, "Get out! You're not getting him!" Twice now they failed to exorcise this demon or demons. Now at 12:30 September 9th, David, the 11-year-old boy, is under possession again. A barrage of hostile accusations and vulgarities followed. The women were called bleeps, 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 and bleeps. Only the book. This book's not for Christians who can't stand a damn or two. I mean, there's some strong language in this book. I want you to know that when the demon speaks his foul filth through this little boy. The men were hit with insulting accusations and were threatened with death for going through with the exorcisms. Too cold now. Paul Bartsch called Ed Warren. By the time Paul returned to the living room a minute later, David was utterly wild. Arnie and Carl Sr. were doing all they could to hold the boy back as he struggled and strained to get at the priest, particularly Father Vergilak. It had begun. One by one, the priests donned their purple stoles, determined to see this siege to an end. With the strength David exhibited, it was a 10-minute battle just to get him down on the floor where he could be controlled. David's body was so imbued with force that four men were required to hold him down. That isn't any stranger than the demoniac boy of the Gadarenes. Father Vergilak traced a cross in the air, then with the other priest beside him, he began the exorcism. The demon cried out, "I'm more powerful than God." "Silence," Father Vergilak commanded, holding a small crucifix up to the boy. From his position on the floor, David spat on the cross 10 feet away. "You'll never exorcise me, you son of a bleep and bleep bleep." Again, Father Vergilak began the process by attempting to anoint David with holy oils. Can't help but laugh at this. Don't send, you know, amateurs to exorcise demons that have gone this far. As he came toward David with the oil, the entity and the child broke out in insane laughter. "That's the wrong oil, you holy fool!" And the thing was right. The thing was right. The priest had inadvertently opened the wrong vial. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Answer the phone. The King's House won. With the struggling, spitting, and biting, it took another 10 minutes just to anoint David's forehead with the oils. Once applied, the holy oils trickled into David's mouth. He then spat it back into Father Vergilak's face. Half an hour later, the physical struggle continued unabated. Alan and Carl Jr. were called in to help. Father Vergilak began reading the exorcism over the boy. But from the very first word, there was resistance. Virtually every word the priest said was met with a crude rebuttal or just shouted down. At 1:30 a.m., only the most minimal progress had been made. The mental and physical resistance exerted by the possessing entity in the child was just as strong as it had been at the beginning. The struggle was constant. Just holding David down was a monumental task, while out of his mouth spewed a ferocious spate of humiliating and degrading lies about everyone present. For the next 30 minutes, the major interruption was a tirade of accusations and filthy name-calling directed first at Father Vergilak, then at Father Grosso. The entity then made reference to the priest's families and alluded to its interference in their lives. "Too bad about your brother," to one he said. "You lied to your sister. This is going to kill your father. I'll make your nephew blind." By 2 o'clock, Father Vergilak was at the point in the ritual of rebuking the entity and commanding it to leave. This brought on a new wave of violent resistance. Infused with a bolt of strength, David suddenly broke free from constraint and started to run berserk. It took more time to bring the boy under control. In response to the commands of exorcism, read line by line, there was constant verbal resistance with the demons in the boy. You say, how could they talk? Well, same way they did through the demoniac boy of the Gadarenes in the New Testament. When shouting and physical struggle didn't work, effusions of spit poured out of the boy. Then his whole body was caused to vibrate up and down. This was followed by a choking seizure. David turned blue and stopped breathing. His chest swelled. By 3 a.m., the defiance, both physical and mental, by the entity was undiminished. It was the people who were wearing down. "Get out of my brother," Debbie screamed. "Get out, get out." She was hysterical and had to be led from the room. Father Vergilak persevered. "Who are you? What is the name by which you are called? Reveal your name," he commanded. In reply came defiance and verbal garbage. "By the authority of God, I command you to say who you are or say the name of Jesus." "No, never." The command was repeated 4 times. Finally, the entity broke. "My name is Legion. We are many." Yeah. entirely possible the demon force was just mocking him, picking the name out of the New Testament event as a diversion to beg the question. Or it's possible you have identical or similar situation as the demoniac of the Gadarenes. Most likely, a diversion attempt to get the priest to quit before the job was fully done. Did this mean there was one or many? Before the night was over, both Ed Warren and those in Brookfield learned the answer. Unknown to those surrounding David that night, another crucial part of the exorcism was taking place 25 miles away. The scene was Ed Warren's study. There alone, between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m., Ed Warren received the visitation of a very high and profound order. He was confronted by the origin of all the trouble. That night, Ed Warren saw the devil that possessed David. The entity was not there by chance. It had been summoned by Ed Warren deliberately for the purpose of binding the beast. When Paul Bartz called and reported that David came under possession just after midnight, states Ed Warren, I knew what had to be done. Two exorcisms had failed. The beast entity had to be bound. It had to be made to obey. Binding is an essential part of the Roman exorcism in which the entity is not only expelled from the body, but it is commanded or bound by the law of God not to seize a particular human being again. Now, at the demoniac of the Gadarenes in the New Testament, they recognized the authority of Jesus right off. They asked permission to go in the pigs. They're not so ready to recognize everybody else. Indeed, there's another occasion in the New Testament where they say they recognize Jesus and somebody else too. But not, who are you? But the name of Jesus and the authority over demons, subject to the conditions of scriptural authority, they recognize that. You remember the TV series Masada. Well, remember when the Roman commandant came with the little sealed up scroll that was his authority from Caesar. He was Caesar when he acted. When the exorcism is done right, the authority is in the name, the blood of Christ which conquered, the outpoured life, and a binding can also be effective, but it hadn't been cleared by the Roman Catholic diocese hierarchical authority in the area. Binding is an essential part of the Roman exorcism, in which the entity is not only expelled from the body, but is commanded or bound by the law of God not to seize a particular human being again. I know I'm in areas not too sympathetic to the Catholic faith. I admire these people. They know who the enemy is. While some of my Protestant friends are shooting the wounded Christians and dumping on them all day long, at least these people know who the enemy is. A diabolical entity that is not bound by the exorcist is capable of possessing again and again. Therefore, binding, in effect, is the killing stroke. But no binding procedure was going to take place in Brookfield. It couldn't. It hadn't been authorized. The Roman ritual hadn't been authorized because of church politics and bureaucratic insensitivity. Only time I found the Warrens ready to criticize. And I can tell you, to finish the job, ultimately, they had to leave the diocese in New England and go to Quebec in Canada, where the authority of the church there, uninfluenced by whatever was influencing the Connecticut diocese, sent a mature and seasoned exorcist to finish the job. And in this book, there's some harsh criticism of the particular Catholic diocese. who abandoned the family ultimately and took the position. Their job was finished in the exorcism of the boy, even though the exorcism of the boy was not completed until it was done by the priest obtained from Canada. And they refused to be involved in anything outside of this one exorcism of the boy, repeated several times and not completed by the Connecticut priests. And those priests were immediately, as the murder trial took place, bad publicity began to rise. Some sent to Rome and others shifted to other places. Sometimes seen Ed and Lorraine criticize their own church, but they criticize the diocese in that area rather harshly for the way they handle the matter. Ed is trying in his own lay way to do what had not been authorized by the church. My intention was therefore, he said, to summon the lead entity to me in the name of God, of course, and bind it to a mystical law it must obey. Thou shalt not possess other creatures of God as thy own. If I could bind the lead entity as I'd done before in other cases, then the priests, within the authority that they had, could exorcise the remaining spirits in the boy. This would effect a full exorcism and permanently free David from bondage. What I didn't count on was the complexity of the spirit that arrived. Now, I read to you last night the horror of this young boy as he went through an experience of seeing these hideous creatures materialize in front of him. You say, well, did they really materialize? How would I know? I'm as unbelievable as you. I only am reading the story, seeing the results, and the boy felt they did. And I'm going to lead you to something else tonight in shamanism, the same type. I didn't count on the complexity of the spirit that arrived. Having commanded the entity to appear, using the steps prescribed in a religious manual, Ed Warren felt the room grow exceptionally cold. Since the beast needed heat to manifest itself, Ed knew it was coming. The stench of putrid flesh filled the air. Then Ed heard distant screechings. As a death-like stillness permeated the room, a sense of immense danger and jeopardy filled Ed's heart. Then suddenly, and that's where we were last night, what came through was an entity so horrendous, so radically different, so consummately powerful that it cannot be accurately described. What confronted Ed Warren from 20 feet away was not even remotely human. It was a pulsing, tar-black mass 7 feet tall. Its body was glossy and throbbing. But it was to its head that Ed's eyes were drawn. Its head was twice the size of a man's. And it, too, was pulsating in black. I was wrong. That's where we were when we stopped last night. Now, the question is, we've been at this so many days, are you tired of this subject?
No, sir.
Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Am I frustrating you?
Yes, sir.
What confronted Ed Warren from 20 feet away was not even remotely human. It was a pulsing, tar-black mass 7 feet tall. Its body was glossy and throbbing, but it was to its head that Ed's eyes were drawn. Its head was twice the size of a man's, and it, too, was pulsating in black. I don't think I should go on this. Richmond, Virginia. Just started listening. You're a smart like a fox. You're not crazy. You're sock dangling Annabelle. Yes, we're frustrated. Dallas, Texas. You going to talk about Don Juan? Yep. Yep. Now let's get on with this. Turn the lights down. Its head was twice the size of a man's, and it too was pulsating in black. It did not have one face. It had many. Suddenly the thing was there. What came through was an entity so horrendous, so radically different, so consummately powerful that it cannot be accurately described. What confronted Ed Warren from 20 feet away was not even remotely human. It was a pulsing, tar-black mass 7 feet tall. Its body was glossy and throbbing. But it was to its head that Ed's eyes were drawn. Its head was twice the size of a man's, and it too was pulsating in black. It did not have one face, it had many. There were features that might be classified as eyes and a nose and a mouth, but nothing stayed in one place. Every few seconds the face changed, and with each change came an incredible, new, grotesque appearance. Some were mutilated. Some showed as human abominations with hairy boils on the skin, swollen eyes, and torn mouths. Others were unworldly monsters with jagged horns protruding from the cheekbones, the forehead, or the temples. Still others looked distinctly animalistic, with a large reptilian eye, or eyes the size of baseballs and the snout of a lizard. What Ed Warren saw resided far beyond the confines of human experience. What I saw, explained Ed, was the full show of faces that David vividly described all summer. His descriptions were accurate. What he didn't know, because to him each image was projected as a separate entity in his horrifying experience, was that all 43 could become one. And every face had a meaning. Every travail David and his family experienced came through in the faces. Hate, rage, violence, profanity. Each face was severe, shocking in fact, but as a whole the entity was overwhelming. It could not be dealt with by Ed. Binding was impossible, he said. If I had started, it would have killed me. I stepped back from the thing, which was growing larger as I watched, and released it from the command by which I had summoned it. The entity lingered a few moments, then was gone. In Brookfield, the task of exercising this pernicious, multifaceted, diabolical power from David continued without let-up. Satan, take my life, take my soul, take me, Satan, take my soul. These pleas were bellowed out in David's voice, or what sounded like him, in resistance to the increasing commands of exorcism. Emotions were frantic. Nerves were raw. Then the voice would come forth as David's. Mommy, mommy, please, this is David Michael Glatzel. Make them stop. Please make them stop. I can't make it anymore. Tell them to stop. Please, mommy, hurry. I need a rest. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Again and again, the possessing entity brought David to the point of death, trying to blackmail the priest to stop. Many times the tactic almost worked. This was the situation as the clock reached 4:30 a.m. It's killing my baby. It's killing him. Judy, his mother, shrieked, finally breaking down. I'll kill him. I'll kill him. I swear I'll kill him, the diabolical thing declared. On the floor, David lay stone cold still. It appeared as though David had actually experienced a heart attack. The pulse and heartbeat were nil. The boy's skin grew white. His body lay motionless, seemingly depleted of all life. By the time a full minute had passed, those in the room could not help but take it for real. At this uniquely wrong point in time, Arnie Johnson made the tragic mistake. Now, Arnie's the one that will subsequently commit murder under a demon possession act and be sentenced to the year 2001. Arnie Johnson, all night long, had been holding David's arms and legs. He'd been like an older brother. Now, Arnie is living with Debbie, preparing to marry and set up housekeeping. The three boys that are younger brothers of Debbie looked on him as an older brother. And when you read the whole book, the warmth and care of Arnie comes through repeatedly, again and again. All night long he'd been holding David's arms and legs. All night he had fought and overpowered the physical strength of the entity. Now David lay limp, white, and apparently dying. Desperate to save David's life, Arnie cried out, "Let David live. Take me on. Come into me." Deep, coarse laughter promptly erupted from David's inert body. "Suckers. Fools." The action caused Lorraine to burst into tears. She's the one, parapsychological, who can discern spirits, Ed's wife. "I immediately sensed that Arnie Johnson had made a very grave mistake, that somehow he would be made to pay for his challenge. Not even a priest would say such a thing. Arnie made the statements selflessly to help David at the expense of himself, but he was ignorant of the responsibility he was taking on by making such an invitation. He didn't know that this thing, instead of releasing David, could actually possess them both now. Each of them in their own way." Father Bogulik had to stop, take Arnie aside, and sternly warn him, "Don't ever say that again." By 5:30 a.m., the possessing entity had indulged in every possible ploy, both physical and intellectual, to disrupt and stop the exorcism. Finally, there came a sign of weakening. Resistance slackened. All night long, the entity had fought to conquer and overwhelm those in the room. It failed to break free and impose its will on all those present. It failed to carry out its threats to kill David up to that point. And most significant of all, it had failed to stop the exorcism, which had persevered. Physical strength was beginning to diminish the boy. Suddenly the tactics changed, and the voice switched to rationalization. "I don't need this fat little body to be here. I've been here before, and I'll be here later." The time had come. That which possessed David Glatzel could either remain and be forced to capitulate to the commands of the exorcist, or it could stop the possession and withdraw. The latter possibility posed the largest danger, for if the entity withdrew without concession, control would be lost, possession might end, but the case would not. "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave this boy's body. Be gone. Leave him in peace," Father Bogulik said, rasping back. "His soul is mine." Father Bogulik, "His soul is his own. It is of God, not of you. Obey the commands of God set down to you. Leave this vessel of the Lord. Be gone from this lamb's body. Depart this seed of God's creation and return to whence you came." In response came a sudden gasping heave. David's body was stained, both hands and feet arched violently into a bowl, then froze in that posture. His breathing stopped. Anxious moments passed, but again it was only another tactic of interruption. Holy water was administered and David's body crashed to the floor. However, an animal wailing came out of the boy from the burns imposed by the holy water. It was a ruse for sympathy, but it didn't work. The Lord commands you, His Son commands you, the Holy Spirit commands you, cease your audacity, cease your wickedness, flee from this boy. Your strengths are weak against the might of God. Cede the wrongness of your act. Release your ignoble grasp. Surrender to God what is His. Depart and be gone from this child forever. This I command you in the name of Jesus Christ. Again the voice. His soul belongs to me. Depart from him. Never. Depart from him. No. Depart from him. His soul is mine. Depart from him. Stop it. Shut up. Shut up. Depart from him. Cease and depart from him. I'll kill you for this. There'll be no killing. Depart from him. I will kill him. You will kill no one. Depart from him. I will possess another. You will possess no one. Depart from him. You have no authority. Depart from him. I don't obey you. Let's leave it right there.